Welcome back to The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. The national debt's about $17 trillion and growing. Doesn't matter what political party you're in, you'll agree, that's a lot of money. But is it too much? Is it out of control? Are we in a national crisis? And are we, as a nation, ready to deal with it? We're talking about America's fiscal constitution, its triumph and collapse. That's the name of the book written by Bill White, and the national debt. Give us a call. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. Do you think that the national debt's gotten out of control? Is it a crisis? Bill White, former mayor of Houston, former Democratic nominee for governor, has written that book. Bill, welcome to The Source.
It's great to be with you, David.
So, Bill, is it a crisis?
Yes. It's not a crisis that will cause a collapse of the stock market tomorrow, but with debt at $140,000 plus per household, we are in a situation of compounding interest. We've borrowed more than we paid in interest each year since 2002. And, you know, there's a problem with compound interest. It can be a blessing for the person who saves and reinvests, and it is a curse for the debtor because it accelerates exponentially.
You've written that the United States has incurred high levels of debt five times in our history, but then we quickly balance the budget, usually while getting surpluses and to reduce the debt. And so we've done it before five times. You say we can do it again.
Yeah, we can do it again. For 90% of this country's history, we balanced budget during normal times and only borrowed for four extraordinary purposes, principally fighting wars and dealing with severe economic downturns. But since 2001, we've incurred about half the debt just for routine expenses to finance tax cuts, to finance higher medical expenses, and a variety of other things. No business or family can go on paying for their routine expenses with debt and expect them to remain solvent in the long run.
So,
and you know what? There's something else, David, and that is all that 90% of American history when we only borrowed for extraordinary purposes, people managed to get reelected. So I think there's signs for hope if we can just reform the political party so that they make balanced budgets a priority.
All we got to do is reform the political parties, then problem solved. That's the tough thing to do, man.
Yeah, it's easier said than done. But throughout history, you see right now a huge undercurrent of concern among the American public with this issue. Over 70% of voters support a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. The concern about deficits crosses party lines, and it always has in this country.
So do you support, do you think that's the solution, a balanced budget amendment for the Constitution?
I think that's sort of a symbol. It's not bad, but it won't result in a balanced budget because all the versions of the balanced budget amendment have a fail-safe mechanism, so you can respond to emergencies. What's needed is people elected to Congress and to the White House that are committed to balancing the budget in short order, not just, 30 years from now.
Right. So you write the history of all these times where the United States has run up the debt and then we got a hold of it and we put things back in order. You look at what the different presidents did, Roosevelt and Taft. And what lessons are we to learn from these? Because times were different back then.
Well, times were different, but our values were the same. I mean, basically, Americans from all walks of life, even those with very modest educations, understood that if you incurred debt today, you'd have to pay it back in the future with interest. And it was more expensive to run the country with an added burden of interest, which absorbed more of every tax dollar. You know, conservatives used to realize that you could constrain the growth of government by making its cost more visible with taxation. And progressives resisted undermining domestic programs with the unsustainable financing of debt. I think we can still return to those principles. And in the end of the book, I have some specific lessons learned in the past about how Congress and the president went about making budgets that were abandoned in 2001.
So what are some of those lessons?
Well, for one thing, we need to have honest accounting. We need to separate the trust funds from the normal federal budget, the Social Security Trust Fund, the Medicare Trust Funds, and put those trust funds on at least a break-even basis where we're not borrowing to sustain those trust funds are as we are right now for Medicare Part B. Then we need to force accountability in Congress by having them vote explicitly to incur debt whenever they vote for spending greater than the amount of revenues. The current system is ridiculous, where Congress votes to spend more than available revenues, like it did in January, and then a month later it debates whether to incur debt to pay for it. Most, you know, families, businesses, and every city, state government in the United States, when they vote to incur debt, they make an explicit decision to incur debt.
All right. Let's get our callers in on the conversation. Our number is 614-8980, and Jesse has called in. Jesse, welcome to The Source. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is a pretty interesting subject. Thank you for taking my call. You know, we're constantly, you know, paying Peter robbing Peter to pay Paul, because we don't have a functional Congress. You know, they pass less bills in this time and age than any time in the history of the United States. Am I correct? And so how are we going to get anything done? You know, just like the gentleman said earlier, we're constantly voting in the same idiots, you know, year after year after year. President Obama's been trying to do so much for this country, but you got Congress that are just going to keep that vice grip on. They're more concerned about making this man fail than to giving any type of leeway on making this country functional.
All right, Jesse, thanks.
If you read the book from Peter Schweitzer, Throw Them All Out, you'll come to the conclusion that there has.
All right, Jesse, thanks for that call. We got to get to the answer really quick. So he's pointing towards the political gridlock in Washington, D.C., Bill White, as the problem.
Well, we do have it's not so much partisanship, because we've balanced the budget before in the past when things were highly partisan. My goodness, after the Civil War, people in each party honestly believed that the other party was responsible for the deaths of millions of Americans. And it was a highly partisan atmosphere. What we do need is people who explain the hard choices and trade-offs to people. Look, I was mayor in Houston for 6 years. I went to civic club meetings, and people would want something, you know, more in their neighborhood, or they would want less taxes. And I would explain to them, okay, if we cut the tax rate, here is what we'd have to cut out of the budget. Or if you wanted more services, here's what would happen to tax rates. And we had an adult conversation about that. People didn't always agree with what we did, but they at least understood why we did it.
Okay, we're going to continue our conversation after this quick break. Bill White, former mayor of Houston, former Democratic candidate for governor of Texas, his book, America's Fiscal Constitution. He's got some tough talk about America's budget and our debt. If you've got a question or comment, call in. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. $17 trillion, that's about what the United States owes. That's our national debt, and that number continues to grow. Has it gotten so big that the interest on that is going to eat up our discretionary spending and keeps us, the nation, from being able to take care of some of the problems that we have? Bill White, he's the former mayor of Houston, former Democratic nominee for governor, has written the book about the problem and his solution. The book is called America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. So you say America's Fiscal Constitution. There's nothing in the Constitution right now that says we have to balance the budget, right, Bill?
That's right. But early on in the country's history, Founding Fathers discussed whether to amend the Constitution and concluded that they needed the flexibility to borrow for emergencies, but what they would do is have political principles, which, in the words of James Madison, who is the architect of the Constitution, would be clearly visible to the eye of the ordinary politician. And those principles were that you only borrowed for extraordinary purposes, that everybody knew what you would borrow for, that Congress authorized debt for that purpose, and when the emergency was over, you quit borrowing and you paid down the debt.
So they figured that Americans weren't so dumb enough to spend themselves into oblivion.
Yeah, and this also reflected a widely held belief that, you know, you wanted to create a better future for your kids. I know when I was growing up in San Antonio, my parents were, I'm part of that baby boom generation, where our parents made so many sacrifices to provide us with a good education, to help sustain a, you know, world in which democracy was safe during the period of the Cold War. And that generation, just like people today, want a better future for their kids. And you don't do that by mortgaging future revenues in order to pay today's operating expenses.
Our phone lines are open if you want to join the conversation, weigh in on America's fiscal constitution, whether or not we're in a national crisis due to our $17 trillion debt. Our number is 614-8980, and you can email us at thesource@tpr.org. Kathy has called in. Kathy, welcome to The Source. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd like to know what Mr. White thinks that we're going to be able to cut to balance the budget, because when we've got the military proposing budget cuts, and then having senators say, oh, no, we don't care if you don't want those nuclear submarines. We're going to make them anyway because I want jobs in my district. How would any cuts ever get through?
Thanks for that call, Kathy. Bill White, go ahead.
Well, in the old days, if you had a shared goal of balancing the budget, then it forced people in each party to make some hard choices and set priorities. Then we did it. We did it for generations. It was, you know, whatever the rules were, somebody may decide that a nuclear submarine was more important than a Medicare prescription drug benefit, or they may decide that, you know, nobody ever likes to pay taxes. They may decide that a higher capital gains rate or a higher tax on gasoline was better than eliminating funding for transportation, or they may decide that they wanted to lower taxes and lower spending on a variety of different items. Those were all hard choices, but they were choices that people were willing to make. You know, look, there's been lots of pairs of political leaders from, you know, this is 60, 70 years ago, Harry Truman and Robert Taft, or Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, or that fought on a bunch of stuff, but they had a shared goal of balancing the budget, and they made the trade-offs needed to get there.
When Bill Clinton left office, the national debt clock was running in reverse. It was going down, but then that stopped happening, and now it racked back up. What happened? What changed?
Well, I'll tell you what didn't change. Americans didn't wake up one morning not caring about their kids. In the 2000 election, neither candidate ran, neither Vice President Gore nor Governor Bush ran on a platform of incurring large debts. But you could sort of see what was happening when President George W. Bush, in his first State of the Union address, talked about increasing spending, and then the next thing he used a sort of a humorous comment. He quoted Yogi Berra and said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And then he proposed large tax cuts. Well, if you're going to cut taxes, you're going to have to cut spending, and that did not occur. And maybe if there was those spending cuts, people wouldn't have wanted the tax cuts, but you got to have a national debate about that. You just can't raise spending without raising taxes or cut taxes without cutting spending.
One of the biggest applause lines of that night during that State of the Union was him saying, it's your money. We have a surplus, and we need to be giving it back to you.
That's right, and by my book chronicles the time that as he was speaking at that time, the surplus was already turning to deficit, and he also said in that speech that we owed it to our children and our grandchildren to reduce the national debt by $2 trillion, and we ought to start now. That was not done.
So there are people have ideas of, I guess, myths about what the national debt is. Maybe they don't have a clear idea of what it is and what it means. What do you think people need to know about the national debt that they don't get?
Well, it's not, look, billions or trillions is, you know, an abstraction. President Reagan, when the debt was going to go over $1 billion, described it, you know, as dollar bills stretching around the planet Earth, $100 bills stretching around the planet Earth, or something like that. What's important to think about is this. The current debt is about $140,000 per household and growing. Now, imagine if you had that on your credit report or you had a bill in front of you for that amount of money. And at times in the past, we did it in 2000, it occurred in 2001, it occurred in 2007, when they said, we're going to give you a tax rebate, and people got checks or credits against their taxes. It wasn't a tax rebate because we borrowed that money. Now, imagine if people had gone out to American families and had them sign a loan for that amount. I think people would have realized what was happening at that time. And the problem is that somebody's going to have to pay it back, and they're going to have to pay it back with interest.
Bill White, you served in the Clinton administration as in the Department of Energy. You're an undersecretary of that. You ran as a Democrat for the Texas governor. But these sounds like Republican talking points.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, you know, we have Congressman Ryan who proposes a budget that has years and years and years of borrowing. I hope if I sound like anybody, it'd be my friend, my late friend Lloyd Benson, who represented the state in the Senate, was a Senate Finance Chairman, and was a big part of trying to balance that budget, and which we succeeded to do it in the 1990s, and that was a bipartisan effort, by the way.
So you're saying that is there one particular party better at trying to balance the budget than the other, or we just need to get rid of the whole – you say reform the parties, so to get rid of that idea?
You know, we need to – the tradition of both parties was balanced budgets. That was the tradition for most of the country's history, and I think whether your listeners are Democratic or Republican – or independent, they ought to get involved in the political system and support those candidates in their party who are willing to talk about hard choices that are needed to balance a budget. And I'll point out that things can change very quickly. Back in 1992, the candidates who, with the benefit of hindsight, were, you know, fine individuals, able individuals, George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, they did a good job. They're ranked pretty highly on historians as president. But they were talking about balancing the budgets but didn't have a plan to do it. Mr. Perot went on Larry King Live, and within 2 months he soared into the lead of the presidential race. Now, various things he, you know, Americans doubted after a while whether he'd be a good president, but his ideas took hold.
So some people say that actually balancing the budget would be bad for the economy.
Yeah, that would have been considered a joke for throughout most American history. Yeah,
I've seen that. I'm not trying to just be funny.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. People in both parties, if you sort of corner them, elected officials, well, if it's good to do in 10 years or 20 years, why not just do it today? And there's this idea that, okay, well, it will harm the economy. As I mentioned, Lloyd Benson, he once made a remark, anybody can create the illusion of prosperity by writing a bad check. And you could have, by incurring debt, you may have some very short-run so-called benefit, just like you would if you passed a bad check to buy a suit at a store. But economic growth is based on the growth in the workforce and the increased average productivity per worker. That's math. That is not ideology. That's not Republican or Democrat. That's just standard freshman economics. And you get that by investing in the skills of people, by encouraging business investment in this country, and by, you know, various things that would increase the working age population. You don't do it by borrowing more money.
So do you think that people will take up the book and take up the cause, that this will become viral? Let's get the America's fiscal house in order?
I'm not so self-centered or important that I think I'm some messiah that's going to save the world. But I will say this, each of us can be missionaries. And each of us can urge the candidates we support to get serious about balancing the budget. And we can support people who are willing to speak some, you know, hard truths, but that are necessary for our country to prosper in the future. And I think we can.
Okay.
America is a great country, and we're a lot less divided today than we were at times where we were divided by, you know, regional and
right.
ethnic divides.
Bill White, America's Fiscal Constitution, thanks for joining us. This is The Source on KSTX.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.